You only need to take a short drive in Oregon to realize that the name Applegate is very prevalent around the state of Oregon. There's the Applegate Trail, the Applegate River, the Applegate Valley around it, and any one of a number of other sites that have some reference to Applegate in them. So it should come as no surprise that once in a while our underground history segment, celebrating all things hidden by the dirt at the moment, focuses on something about Applegates. And so this month we're talking with Chelsea Rose at the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology about the Charles Applegate House in Yonkala and a dig there involving folks at the University of Oregon, including historical archaeologist Chris Ruiz. Christopher Ruiz is with the U of O Museum of Natural and Cultural History. Christopher, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And Chelsea, welcome back to the studio.
Hi, great to be here.
So start us off with the importance of the Applegate family to the white settlement of Oregon generally. I mean, we just sort of set the scene here that Applegate's everywhere, it seems like.
Yeah, down here in southern Oregon, you know, we have the Applegate Valley, the Applegate River. Most of our archaeological projects come across one of the Applegates because Lindsay Applegate was an Indian agent in the 1860s and had a toll house, and O.C. Applegate was involved in the Modoc War. So the Applegates are really prevalent in southern Oregon, and Yonkala, where Chris has been working, is really where they originally settled.
How many brothers were there? You just mentioned three, I think. Lindsay, O.C., and Charles.
No, those were kids of Lindsay Applegate. Charles Applegate, Lindsay Applegate, and Jesse Applegate were brothers. Was there more, Chris? I know the three.
Yeah, those were the three brothers that came across the Oregon Trail in 1843 with their families. I'm not sure how many. I think there was, five more that stayed in Missouri and that part of the world that didn't come across.
And Chris, tell us about the importance of the Applegate Trail. It was an alternative to the original Oregon Trail, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I guess it gained some notoriety because it proved to people had issues on it. Chelsea knows a lot more about it than I do.
Well, they had the bad luck of coming across the Applegate Trail their first year in 1846, which was the exact same year of the Donner Party. So a lot of the same winter storm system that affected the Donner Party as they got a little delayed impacted the folks coming over on the Applegate Trail the first year. And it was rough going. And so there was a lot of kind of debate about whether or not it was ethical of them to bring them on it, or if they were kind of tricked into taking this route that wasn't safe.
Well, and wasn't the original creation of the Applegate Trail partly because didn't one of the brothers lose a son on the Columbia River on the original Oregon Trail?
Two of them did, right, Chris?
Yeah, I think it was.
And, you know, kind of the big mythic story of the Applegate family is that they, after losing, because they had to, when you got to, I think it was the Dalles, you had to go on the Columbia River or get across the river to go on land. And so they, rafting, creating a raft, getting everybody on a raft was really dangerous. So they lost two sons, and kind of the early story says that they vowed then and there to make a safer route into Oregon. But that might have been part of their motivation and why they particularly were involved, but there was a lot more to the story, namely that up until that point, this isn't even Oregon Territory time yet in the 1840s. There was only one way into Oregon, and that was all controlled by British. So the United States wanted to have another route so that they weren't so dependent on the Hudson's Bay Company and some of the other folks that were kind of controlling the entry points.
Right, so international relations then had something to do with the creation of the trails into Oregon from the east. So Chris, tell us about the Charles Applegate House. It dates back to 1852, still very much there. Give us a sense of how it's used now and what's there.
Well, it's the oldest known residence that has remained in continuous family ownership since its construction. So the Applegate family still own the property. It was listed in 1974 on the National Register of Historic Places. And as you mentioned, it was built in 1852, located on that original 642-acre donation land claim. And the house is still there. In the 1860s, they added a kitchen to the back, but I think it looks pretty similar to what it was like in the 1850s.
It's a fairly grand-looking house, judging by the pictures of it.
Oh, yeah. It's really Yeah, so it's a grand house.
I just got to visit during Chris's. They had a public day there. And one of the things that's so cool about the house, not only is it this beautiful house, but all the stuff in it is actually from the family. Usually when you go to modern kind of house museums, they have things that are in the same era, but it's not necessarily actual artifacts from the family. But this place is really special because it is so much that's actually was the Applegate family's that's still in the house today that you can see.
So no transplants and recreations. It's the original stuff.
Yeah, and that's been a big emphasis is to maintain this that there's stuff from the family from the 1850s all the way through to the present day, that it's been lived in and used by the family.
And now the place is not consistently open to the public. Is that right, Chris?
Yeah, that's correct. It's managed by a nonprofit, the Applegate House Arts and Heritage Association, and they will open up for various tours and so forth.
I'm giggling a little bit about the acronym. It's actually AHAE for the Applegate House Heritage Arts and Education. That's the name of the nonprofit. We're talking about the Charles Applegate House in Yonkala, Oregon, in northern Douglas County. As part of this month's Underground History segment, Chelsea Rose is our perennial guest here from SULA, the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology. Christopher Ruiz is an archaeologist at the University of Oregon Museum of Natural and Cultural History. Let's talk Applegates. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So, Chris, I can imagine the Charles Applegate House has been the scene of a dig or two. What got you digging out there recently?
Well, this project goes back to 2012. My colleague here at the university, Liz Carter, had been working with the nonprofit for many years and directing historic preservation students towards various interpretive projects. And we put together a class here at the university for preservation students that was designed to introduce them to archaeology, and that archaeology's, often you find it in the same setting as you when you're dealing with old houses or properties. So, traditionally preservation students don't have much awareness of that crossover. But it's definitely important to know about. So we put together a class and used a couple properties as case studies, and the Charles and Melinda Applegate House was one of them that the students got to go out and look at the old air photos and the general land office maps and think about where there might be archaeological resources on the property and talk to the landowners, and then they put together a little class report. And so, and then we did a little field exercise during that project. And one of the things everybody was, the family was interested in was the location of the original the land claim cabin.
Now that was a bit of a mystery, I understand.
What's that?
That was a bit of a mystery?
Yes. Well, it was, there was a kind of oral traditions about where it was, but no one knew for certain, and there's no photos of it that you can point to and go, oh, it was, here. So there's kind of this oral tradition. It was in the field west of the house. And so that's a pretty big field. So that's where we started our investigation.
Well, so let me bring this question back to Chelsea on this or any dig. When you've got lots of room and nobody's really sure where to dig, how do you narrow the focus in the first place?
Well, basically doing a lot of the things they did, using remote sensing to kind of, I think they used ground penetrating radar and maybe some other techniques to see what's under the ground and kind of narrow down the field a little bit so that you can target your excavation. Also, those aerial photos can show differences in the way grass dries, which can give you clues to what's underground as well. And sometimes you can see slight slopes or mounds that you can't see when you're just standing there in the field, and that, again, gives you clues.
Yeah.
The grass drying, tell me that again.
Oh, yeah. So this is something that's a really great trick. We found this again on the coast in Miner's Fort. Even modern fields today, if you're looking from aerial photos at certain times of the year, there's a different rate in which grass can dry in different parts of the property, and that can reflect something underneath, like it's more compact, or there's rocks under there, or it's looser or more organic. And all of that can give you clues and sometimes literally outlines to things that are buried underneath the ground that you can't see if you're standing on the ground.
Oh, so there's a little suspicion of like, why does the grass look different over there? There actually can be a pretty decent answer to it.
Yeah, there's usually a reason, whether it's archaeological or geological or whatever, but there's a lot of clues in that kind of stuff.
Wow. So Chris, I understand you actually found the cabin site 3 years ago, but what else did you find with it?
Well, we haven't, we're not sure we'd know where the cabin site is. We've kind of narrowed the field down to an area, and we're getting, you know, artifacts in that area that are consistent with the period, but we haven't found the hearth or, you know, the corners of the cabin. So we're still kind of in the stage of trying to figure out. We did a recent excavation out there last month and dug a lot more than we had previously, and now we can start cataloging artifacts and looking at the results and seeing if there a pattern emerges.
All right, so you're still not positive on the location.
Whoa.
Not sure what happened there. I think we just lost Chris. Chelsea had a point.
Uh-oh.
No, I'm here.
Oh, okay. What I was going to say is that when you're looking at these really early cabin sites like 1852, they are really tricky to see archaeologically because the wood rots. And that's sometimes they're log cabins, so there is no nails. So the wood can rot. They don't always have rock foundations. And if you don't find the chimney base or if they reuse the rocks for something else, there can be very little left on the ground. That can reflect.
If you'd like
structure.
To make a call, please hang up.
That'd be the red phone. Okay, let's take care of that. There we go. All right. Now, that is now dealt with.
It is Halloween, so maybe the ghost of the Applegate is calling. Calling,
calling Charles Applegate.
But so, you know, Chris has a really difficult task. Some of the early cabins that we've looked at from the early 1850s, it is very ephemeral, and you really have to put together all the different clues you have at your disposal to kind of tell the story.
Okay, so you did. Let me ask this though, because we are talking about historical archaeology here. So there are potentially some records to help you with any digs. I mean, how much, Chris, had the Charles Applegate family recorded about who lived on what became their property?
Well, they have quite an extensive, you know, collection of family photos and letters and so forth, And you know, it's funny about the cabin is there's two pieces of there's a family violin that might show it, and a wood engraving on the back, and then there's a picture drawn in a school book by Harriet Applegate when she was 9 years old that shows a cabin, and it looks like she's drawing what she's drawing something she's looking at instead of something from memory. It shows toys in the yard and. But it's just a drawing, so we don't know what that where that drawing fits in the landscape. That's about the most clues we have. There is a overview shot of the whole property from 1901 that might show a building out there in the area we're looking, but it's really hard to see on the photo.
How many generations deep are we now? I mean, how many greats do we add to the grandparent that Charles and Melinda represent to the people who are in charge of the place now?
Well, the current owners, I think, she's fifth generation, I believe.
And so, there's still story, oral histories that are passed down in the family as well about where things were and what they found when they first got there?
Shannon Applegate, who is the property owner. She wrote a book about the history of the family and their time in Yonkala, and she's very knowledgeable about that history. So, and then they have many, you know, relatives around the area that will, have different stories that they all share. So it was kind of funny. While we were doing the excavation, there was, three different descendants of Applegates. One was of a Lindsay, of Lindsay's family, and then there was another Charlie Applegate descendant. And
Several branches of the family that separated generations ago.
Yeah, but they stay connected, so.
Chelsea had a point?
One of the really cool things about this project is, too, is how collaborative and community-oriented it is. Because it is a family museum, they really brought in a lot of the local community to help work with Chris and his team, and also some of the students and stuff like that, to really teach them about archaeology and use a really local personal example of how, you know, archaeology can impact their community, which was really cool.
This is our Underground History segment on the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about the recent excavation at the Charles Applegate House in Yankala, Oregon, one of the three major Applegate brothers who seemed to generate more generations of Applegates and put the name all across Western Oregon. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk to Chelsea Rose from the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology, Christopher Ruiz from the University of Oregon Museum of Natural and Cultural History, and Mark Tveskov is going to join us as well from SULA on the other line. You can join in at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I think we figured out the phone problems. Mark, are you there?
Yep, I'm here.
Okay, so the Applegate family in particular, this must be a name that comes up frequently in the work that you do, working in the same general period in which they were active.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I mean, the Applegates were all over the settler era here in Southern Oregon, right through the Modoc War and earlier in the River War. I mean, what we were talking about earlier, you know, about this myth about the death of those kids. I mean, that was certainly happened and was a tragic event, but, you know, that was part of a mythology that they were fostering to, like, empire build in Southern Oregon.
Interesting. So these are the apocryphal tales upon which dynasties are built.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, and they were part of the development of trails over the Siskiyou Summit of, you know, definitely an empire building. They ran a toll booth at one point, you know, always working it, always had an angle on something.
Christopher Reed, I want to come back to you because you have found evidence other than just of Applegate family stuff, though, but evidence of native inhabitation at the site. What kinds of stuff have you found?
Oh, well, we found some, you know, flakes from tool manufacture and some various stone tool fragments, and it looks pretty. There seems to be a lot of stuff there, so it has been a well used landscape.
And so how much tribal activity was involved? What sort of oversight as you guys did the dig in September?
Well, we obviously, as part of the state permitting process, we do a consultation with the tribes, and then we also have some. One of the board members for the nonprofit is a tribal elder, and we also had some involvement from the students of the Yankala High School Indian Education Program out with us during our excavation.
So are there any new things to report after this set of digs, things that were not previously known about the Charles Applegate property?
I don't know if there's anything new yet. We're still in this awkward state of we dig and we get a lot of artifacts and then we take it back to the lab, and then there's kind of a whole different process that starts that can be just as informative as the excavation. So now we're cataloging the artifacts and trying to identify what they may date to and what depth they came from and what units. So the pattern that emerges from the artifacts can tell us a lot about what the story. So that's kind of the stage we're in now.
Mark, is there a lot of after the fact sort of stuff that happens in any archaeological work where you're gonna take some things away because you think there's something and then you get them back to the lab and realize yes they are or no they're not?
Yeah, that happens all the time. The majority of the work is after the dig is done and taking responsibility for all the stuff that you dug up and cataloging it, analyzing it, and then there's always surprises that come down the road. You know, we found a bullet lodged in a piece of wood that we happened to bring back to the lab. You know, that happens fairly frequently.
And so, Chelsea Rose, how painstaking a process is this? I have this sense of like a jillion little baggies into larger baggies into bigger bags than that, too.
Oh, absolutely. And one of the reasons why Mark and I are so fortunate to be on a university is because we have students that can help us go through a lot of that stuff. And Chris, too, at the University of Oregon. Yeah. But yeah, sometimes you come back and you find something you didn't realize that was excavated, and it is amazing, and it changes the story. Other times you're like, that's a rock, we can throw those out. You know, so there's a little bit of both, but most of the time we don't really know exactly what we found till we're well into the analysis, and we can kind of recreate what we excavated in the lab and start to see patterns emerge.
So the stuff that is just rocks, what do you do with that? I mean, do you take it back to the site it came from, or is it our future archaeologists going to marvel at the piles of rocks that don't belong in the places where they were found?
Well, I'm sure everybody has their own different strategies, but for us, if it's absolutely not cultural, we will just throw it away. If it's a rock that doesn't belong there, like it's a river rock that's in somewhere that has no water, then we call that a manuport, which is a funny word everybody loves, but it means somebody brought it there, so why? It still could be cultural. So there's a lot of different ways we deal with rocks. We don't dismiss them all, but if it is indeed a rock that is not cultural that somebody thought was something else, we'll just throw it away.
All right.
Or I have a pile on my desk.
Right.
Yeah, I'm going to start using the word manuport around my house. Things that don't belong there. So Chris, I noticed that from the Applegate House site that the dig was expected to cost $25,000. So did the house organization hire you to do this, or how did that all come about?
Well, they you know, we had worked with them previously and sort of over a couple of years developed you know, kind of the next step that we would recommend to do, and it was excavation. And so you know, I put together a budget and kind of a outline of a project, and they took that and started raising funds.
All right. So is there a final set of activities, some final report on what happened out there? I know you had a public day at the end of September.
Yeah. Yes, we had at the end of the excavation, we had the public day, and then we're working on a report that they will get a copy of and send to the various funding sources as a deliverable.
Okay, and as we pointed out, it's not like the Charles Applegate House is consistently open to the public, so it's worth checking out the Applegate House Heritage Arts and Education Organization website, which will give you a clue to things that are going on there. Christopher Ruiz, an archaeologist at the University of Oregon Museum of Natural and Cultural History, spent some time digging there this summer. He's here as part of our underground history segment with Chelsea Rose from Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology and Mark Tveskov, who joins us by phone, I guess from Connecticut again. Hi, Mark.
Hello.
Thanks, all of you, for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having me.
All right, take care.